Welcome back, everybody. This is Sight to the Blind. First, I want to bring out to the called out assembly. We have a brother that is struggling with backsliding. If you can, keep your prayers in mind for Brother McFadden. He is struggling through backsliding. And I said this before in this show. When you are in the Ruach HaKodesh and you are dwelling in the Spirit, doing the commandments, living upright, living righteously, and you backslide, you will feel the Ruach HaKodesh leave you. And that is what this brother is struggling with. And now that he has to face the shame of the Ruach HaKodesh leaving him, leaving his Ruach, and now you feel the need for repentance. But first you go through the emotions of knowing you are backsliding, which I say is the fastest way of knowing that you are on the right path. The Most High said that we will never be perfect and we will always fall short of his glory. Even Abraham, through all of his trials, if Abraham was perfect, he wouldn't have gone through these trials if Abraham was perfect. He wouldn't need his faith tested and tried through trials and tribulations if Abraham was perfect. He became perfect because he succeeded every trial. Now, I told this brother there's a difference between backsliding and backsliding knowing the shame of backsliding. When you backslide and you say, you know what, I'm just not taking this path, this walk serious, or I don't see the fortune in this walk, and you just backslide, that means you already just turned back and you don't feel anything for it. You don't feel anything for the Most High. You don't feel anything for this walk. You just want to continue on going. That's real backsliding. But when you come to me or you come to somebody and you say, well, I'm backsliding, you know when to stop. The Most High is letting you go through these emotions, this process, but he knows when to tell you to stop. Now, he ain't doing this for everybody. He has not casted you out. He has not led you amongst the reprobates. He hasn't given you over to an unclean mind. If he did, you wouldn't have cared. You wouldn't come out and reach out to those and saying that you are backsliding and you feel terrible for doing it and you feel worthless. You feel like your life doesn't matter. You think that you're better off gone. This is all the work of the Most High. So when you get back on this path, you don't repeat the same process. Now, mind you, I'd said this before numerous of times, and I've shared with you numerous of times that even I stumbled through this walk. I backslid multiple times. It wasn't just one or two times. It was multiple times. And the Most High called me back each time. And each time I perfected what I kept failing in. And it's only because I've read enough scripture and have a better memory call of scripture to keep me on this path so I don't feel worthless or feel that I'm better off gone. Because I'm telling you, cutting your life off or asking for your life to be cut off in the midst of backsliding, it's not going to be good for you. Why call the Most High to send you into Sheol when the work has not yet done? Why cut off to the point where your wickedness and your backsliding is all you're ever going to be remembered for with the Most High? And I said you have to build up that altar, continually building up that altar. When you backslide, yeah, you're not fully choosing the opposite way, but you're stumbling. Don't let the Most High flip your altar over, send you into Sheol, and you did all this back and forth for nothing, and learned nothing out of it. So in the day of judgment, you meet him and shows you the treasure of works shows you your words, shows you your deeds. Don't let your backsliding be the only thing you have left to your name. Fourth book, Ezra, chapter 16, 74 through 78. Hear, O ye my beloved, says Yahuwah, behold, the days of trouble are at hand, but I will deliver you from the same. Be ye not afraid, neither doubt, for Yahuwah is your guide, and the guide of them who guard my commandments and precepts, says Yahuwah. Let not your sins weigh you down, and let not your iniquities lift up themselves. Even those who guard and guide the commandments and precepts still stumble, still are entrapped by the snares of this world. He's saying, not that you will ever sin by guarding my commandments and precepts. He's saying, if you do sin, if there is iniquity among you, do not let it weigh you down, and do not let your iniquities lift up themselves. Woe be unto them that are bound with their sins and covered with their iniquities, like as a field is covered over with bushes, and the path thereof covered with thorns, that no man may travel through. Now look at your life. Now, through your stumbling and your backsliding, are you heaping sin upon sin on your household? Are you covering your ruach with sins and iniquities? I don't think you are, my brother. I don't think you are. It is left undressed and it is cast into the fire to be consumed therewith. You are not leaving your sins undressed. If you were, you wouldn't come to me, or you wouldn't feel the shame that you feel for backsliding. This is all part of the walk. This is all to strengthen your ruach. So I'm asking the called out assembly to keep Brother McFadden in your prayers. Truly. Because when we go through times like this, we have no one to talk to, and we feel we have no one to talk to, but this is why I bring it out to the assembly. This is why we build a community. We're not building churches. We're not building 501c3s. We're building a community, an assembly that transcends buildings, tithes, offerings, sowings of seeds, playing music and jumping around, falling out, speaking in gibberish. So we're trying to call this brother back into the fold, to get him back on the path and to keep going. Like it says in Genesis or Exodus, you cannot muzzle the ox once it starts treading out the grain. So you already started on this path, bring it to its completion. And backsliding is not the completion that you want. I wanted to talk quickly about this whole trial with Austin Metcalf and Carmelo Anthony. Now, I could go through the numerology of it, but I'm not going to go through all of it. Carmelo Anthony played his last game as a Knick player in 2017. If you take that date to the day that Carmelo Anthony with the K supposedly stabbed Austin Metcalf, it was 7 years and 11 months. Carmelo Anthony was notified that he was going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer on the same exact day that Carmelo Anthony with the K stabbed Austin Metcalf at this track meet. Somehow people have not put it together. Some people think it's just some weird coincidence. I said this before, the numbers 42 and 59 are implanted on Negroes in this country. When you see celebrities die or old celebrities die, they die at 59. Frankie Beverly, of Frankie Beverly and Maze, he died at 59, I believe. 42 and 59. Those of you who watched the TV show Martin, what was his his apartment number. It was 42. Brittany Griner, the man that plays in the WNBA. What's his number? 42. Jackie Robinson. What was the number that he came out with for the Brooklyn Dodgers? 42. 42 and 59. Why? Because 42 in a reduction cipher of gematria is the N-word. 59 means Negro. It means slave. It means cotton picker. And even in the numerology of the N-word, 59 is found in the N-word. So 5 and 9 are N and I, and 5 and 9 is G, is the E and the R. So it's like a bookend. It's 59 on the front end and back end with 77 in the middle. That's in a reduction cipher, not in ordinal, where it's A equals 1, B equals 2, C equals 3. It's a reduction cipher. But that's why they keep using it. So two men of the same name, spelled differently, are mentioned on April 2nd, 2025. This is before we even knew that the New York Knicks were going to be in the finals. And look where they're at. They're in the finals with a player who played for the Knicks, and now they ran this court case at the same time that the Knicks are in the finals with the San Antonio Spurs. And let's go into this case a little bit. They said that Auston Metcalf was stabbed in the heart after an altercation at a track meet. Mind you, when you have a track meet at a high school, there are more than one teams. There's more than one team at this track meet, right? And they all kind of sit amongst each other. They're not really separated because they sit up in the bleachers. So you're trying to tell me it has to be more than one high school team. You're trying to tell me there is no other witnesses from any other teams that saw or recorded Carmelo Anthony stabbing Auston Metcalf. I mean, that's pretty hard to not to have evidence of any cell phone footage of this altercation, especially in this generation, loves to bring out their cell phones and record and go live for any purpose, for anything. Anytime you've seen an argument between teenagers or between anybody, people are so now in this generation to quick to bring out their cell phones. But you have no cell phone footage of this altercation. If you look at the crime scene, you just see a couple of book bags. What was this, like a seven-man track team? There was another track team whose tent was right next to theirs. It was called, I think it was Liberty Red Hawks. So you got the Liberty Red Hawks not far from the Warriors, whatever that school's name that Auston Metcalf and Carmelo Anthony went to. They're not that far apart. You just see book bags, but you don't see enough book bags to make you believe that it was actually a track team. You just saw a couple of book bags scattered. And mind you, you don't even see blood. You don't see blood splatters. You don't see anything when they show you that crime scene from a drone or helicopter. You don't see any blood. And if you look at that crime scene, wherever they had this altercation at, it was right near the track. So you're trying to tell me no one in the infield is called to be a witness? And they did it literally right, almost right at where the finish line is of the 100-yard dash. You trying to tell me nobody's walking in front of this tent? That no one's on the track paying attention to the commotion that it started in the stands? That makes no sense to me. It really doesn't. No one has ever seen any cell phone footage of Auston Metcalf with his brother since his brother died in his twin brother's arms. No one sees the footage or recording of Auston Metcalf being put in an ambulance. You don't see it. You don't hear about it. And then you go through the trial, and they say they have this surveillance footage. Now, mind you, there's just nobody sitting around outside saying that they know who Carmelo Anthony really had the issue with, or they jumped him and they surrounded him. You hear all types of different testimonies from people who are grown adults who weren't even there. And they're telling you what they heard from inside the supposed courtroom. So they shut all the conduits of where you would think the truth would be. They shut it down, and all you hear is what somebody else heard from inside the courtroom. And you don't ever know if it was anybody even in the courtroom. When they start doing these little sketches during some of these court cases, that's when you should know that it don't make sense. All of a sudden, they don't allow cameras in one of the most famed court trials. They let us in on the O.J. Simpson case, but they won't let you in on a 19-year-old being accused of murder, which is a really basic case. It's a basic open and shut case. But they didn't want any cameras in there. I don't know why. Because people were just going to pour out of the courtroom and run to media and tell them what they heard. And you're relying all your facts and your truth to come, or your narrative to come from people who told you they were in the courtroom. So they told you about the surveillance tape, which doesn't make sense to me, because when do they allow surveillance tapes or people to record track meets among children? What track meet you ever been to that they have surveillance footage? Especially if your school isn't predominantly black, or if it's not in a low income and it's not in a low income community. I mean, this ain't like Lean On Me East Side High. So what surveillance footage would they have? And they said it was grainy. So they don't even have good surveillance equipment? Why wouldn't you show this? They show everything else. They show body cams. Why wouldn't you show this illicit tape? If it's just an open and shut case, you know he didn't defend himself. Why not put it out there? If he was doing it in self-defense, why not put that out there either? I mean, obviously we're going to find out. But I don't believe so. They could come out with AI. They can come out with anything they show you. But it doesn't make sense to me why they withhold the surveillance tape, and why would they be surveilling a track meet if multiple schools aren't really problematic schools? And then they skip right into that and go into GoFundMes. That was another red flag for me. When you start seeing GoFundMes pop up for Austin and Carmelo, and then they show that he bought a house, that was just flavor. That's just to get you into an emotional rage over two individuals that you do not know about, nor any facts of this case other than he stabbed him. Did they show you the knife? Did they show it being blood splattered? Did they show you the Ziploc bag that they put it in? I mean, do y'all just listen to what they tell you and just jump online and then all of a sudden try to defend somebody that you don't even know of? And Negroes who are Israelites or awakened, they do this too. They do this too. And I follow some of them. People who pushing the word. Oh, we are the Jews. We are the Israelites. As soon as a case like this happens, then it becomes, oh, this system is broken. This is broken. It completely changed their ruach into the worldly ruach, and try to defend somebody who was not following the law, statutes, commandments. Because that's what I base all of my emotions on when people are caught in certain circumstances. He died? Was he following the Torah? Because if it's on TV, I guarantee you he didn't follow it. Oh, a child died? Was the parents following the Torah? That child wouldn't have died if their parents was following the Torah. The Most High said, I will visit the sins of the iniquities of the fathers to the fourth and fifth generation of them that hate me. So being in a religion, doing these pagan feast days, regardless if you had the Most High awaken you or not, or even gave you clue to the real truth and you ignored it in your lifetime, that is a form of hating him. He said this in Proverbs 1:26 and to the end of that chapter. I will mock you when calamity comes. I called you, you did not want to answer. I reached out my hand, you did not want to take it. So why would I be upset when a Tamir Rice gets executed by a cop? Why would I feel something about Trayvon Martin when I know his dad is a Prince Harvey Mason and was probably instrumental in setting up his own son? Same thing with Philando Castile. But they pumped him up, said, oh, he was a well-liked individual in this school that he was working in. And then his uncle, who was a Prince Harvey Mason, jumps on and becomes the mouthpiece for the entire family. I mean, the same thing with Charlie Kirk. Why would I care? Because he quotes a couple of scriptures and they try to make him righteous by all these little debates that he has across campuses. And he gets shot in the neck. Why would I feel anything for him? Even though I know he didn't get shot in the neck and they proved that to be AI. Why would I care? Were they following the law, statutes, commandments? Were they doing the biblical feast days? You don't get to hear any of this when they bring up any of these cases in front of you, because it's only used for race baiting issues. It's only used to push a race war. And I said this before, they need the Negro to intertwine themselves with every race ideology, every victimhood story, and every racial story that can create a race war. They need you. They need you to be the battery. You are the battery. That's it. That's all they do it for. And some of you Negro Israelites, you awaken Negroes, some of y'all fall for it. So then you go online talking about, oh, this justice system is broken. It's supposed to be broken. It ain't supposed to be for us. This is not our justice system. By following the law, statutes, commandments of the Most High, it keeps us away from man's law, statutes, and commandments. Job said the world has been given into the hands of the wicked. Where are the judges? They cover the faces thereof. What do you thought was going to happen? Even if the story was real and he was doing it in self-defense, he still got caught. That's on the Most High. Now, if Austin Metcalf is dead, it's because he did follow the law, statutes, and commandments. If he gets stabbed up, because he wasn't in the Torah, nor his family members are in the Torah. Oh, well. They want y'all to feel so much for these people. That's why they open up GoFundMe accounts and you don't even know if that money is even going to that family. If they put that in front of your face and the first thing you see is GoFundMe accounts, I know it's a Freemason behind it, working both sides. And I know who's behind the Freemasons collecting that money, but from both sides. So they raised, what, $500,000 for Carmelo, and they raised almost equally that much for Austin Metcalf's family. Where do you think that money went? You think it went to the pockets of those families? No, it did not. There was already a photo being released. There was a photo released showing Joe Metcalf, Austin Metcalf's father, the DA, and the judge at a Christmas party together taking pictures. I mean, what more do you need to let you know it was all fake? What more? After we've exposed that they do fake celebrity deaths, that they do have a city that's underground in Colorado, a whole city of people that you could just put underground. I told you that R. Kelly was videoed at a barbershop. A guy said he saw R. Kelly in a barbershop, and R. Kelly's supposed to be in jail. But I know he's not in jail because he's a Prince Harvey Mason. The same thing with Sean Combs. He's not in jail. Ghislaine Maxwell, she's not in jail. Why would these people who are at the top of their priesthood in Freemasonry, Zionism, why would they ever spend a day in jail doing what Satan has called them to do, which is one of their ordinances and statutes is to serve through flesh? Why would they ever get caught? Especially if the whole court system and the judges and the lawyers are Freemasons. If they're not Freemasons, they're Zionists or Talmudists. And you know what they believe? They believe that the Gentile are animals. So why would they care? If they think the so-called Goyim is only meant to serve Zionism or serve the Talmud, why would they put them in jail and lock them up? They would want them out to continue deceiving others and enforcing behavior that you could do anything and everything you want if you join us. Pretty much what Satan implements as doctrine in all religions. Do whatever you want. Don't have to worry about it. Jesus or God will take care of it. He knows that you are imperfect and you're a sinner. You do not need to seek after righteousness. That's why Christians don't worry about backsliding. Muslims don't worry about backsliding. Judaism, they don't worry about backsliding. They don't have to worry about it. Because they're not going to get punished. They never felt the real Ruach HaKodesh. They never felt shame in what they do because they obviously they don't because they keep doing it. Christians don't say, oh man, I'm mad that I did another Christmas. I'm mad I did another Easter. I'm mad I did another Thanksgiving. Oh, I'm mad I'm celebrating my birthday again. That you don't hear any post, you don't hear or see any post about any Christian feeling bad for doing pagan holidays. Now, mind you, there's some that may stop after finding out it was pagan. But for the most part, you don't see them online talking about how they're backsliding into paganism. They don't think they're doing anything wrong. So that's how you know that most of the world is covered in sin. They don't know what true backsliding is. So anyway, yeah. That whole entire case was foolish to me. From the beginning to the end, it didn't make any sense. And all he did was show you a couple of pictures to piss you off, especially white folk. Carmelo started off with a GoFundMe, then all of a sudden you heard that all his family bought a house off the money that people sent him. Like, oh, look, his parents already got a house. Oh, and that enraged white folk. Enraged. A young black kid stabs another young white kid in the heart, and then he gets a house for it. I mean, in Freemasonry, that's exactly how it would work. You sacrifice somebody, your parents, or you reap the benefits because you participated in said ritual and said psyop. Which is what they do to these artists. Like Rick Ross, he recently got busted for flying commercial. He said he flew commercial to go to a party or a party with Trick Daddy in Colombia. And that's why he flew commercial. And he said his private jet is being fitted with Starlink, with Elon Musk internet. And everybody joked on him and said that Starlink costs but $200. Why would they need to go into this big hangar and to be fitted with Starlink? I mean, like I said before, these artists are put in these mansions and are giving these planes to promote a lifestyle that they are not living. If you look at the music world, ever since they went to streaming, they took all of the power, all of the rights, and all of the money out of the hands of the artists and put them back into the hands of the record companies so that the artists are in perpetual debt. You cannot dig yourself out of debt with streaming. I'm sorry. Commercials ain't paying the bills. You need to move units. And back in the day, artists were getting rich because they can move units. That means you needed an entire record company to push, or you need them to make a CD or a tape. Then you had to encase this CD or tape with artwork. Then from there, you have to put it into the store. Someone had to go and buy it, and you had to buy the case. You had to buy the CD or tape that it's in there with, along with the cover art. You had to do all of this. The days of Michael Jackson pushing $1 million in a week, pushing a lot of units to get $1 million in a week, that's money. That's hard money. Streaming is nothing. Since they started breaking up albums with $1.99 or $1.29, you could pick whatever song you want off this album and just pay for it. That's when I knew that the music industry was failing. And then it went straight to Spotify. Then you don't have to pay. You pay a subscription, $9 to hear everybody's album. How are these artists making money? I don't know. But I know that Rick Ross does not have the mansion that he has out here in Florida based on Wingstop. I know that much. I have enough common sense to know that he's not making that much money. When the last time a Rick Ross album hit a million? Now, gold is, okay, 500,000. Gold. And you take the publishing, you take touring, you take concerts, you take some of that stuff away from these artists, they're not making the money that allows them to afford private jets and mansions. He did a thing on, Architect Digest. They do a little thing with celebrities where they show them the houses. And I'm telling you, it was so cringy, and you could tell that it was just like his stuff was in there of a house that he was renting. That's what it looked like. It was not personable, or it wasn't. It didn't even look like his style. It's just whatever was in there at the time that they were selling this mansion, they just threw him in there and said, put your shoes and your clothes in here. Because that's all he went to. That's the only personable stuff that he had, was just his clothes and his shoes, his jewelry, and a couple of album stuff just sitting on the front, on the ground, like those little CD poster or CD plaque things that he has. But anybody can put those up on the wall. But when he was going through the house and he was talking about the things that was in the house, I could tell that he didn't buy it and he didn't know what he was talking about. You should just look it up. Look up Rick Ross's house on AD. They have a YouTube channel. Just look it up and just watch it. It is hilarious, yo. Truly, it's hilarious. Watch it and come back to the comment section of this episode. I just want to hear your thoughts, because he cannot sell the fact that that's his house. The same with the DJ Khaled. He is a DJ. Why does he have? I wouldn't even say it's a beachfront, because his house sits almost in front of the Fountain Blue, on the other side of the river or canal that goes through South Beach on Ocean. If you look up his household, there's no way in the world he can afford that either. Being a DJ, not even producing music, but producing mixtapes. That's basically what he was famous for, producing mixtapes that had other artists on his mixtapes that he had to pay. That the record company comes out of their pockets to have all these artists on one song on this album with all these assortment of artists. How is he making this much money to have the house that he's living in? I mean, he had a good run in the early 2000s to like 2007, 2008. But after that, it died off. You don't hear any albums from DJ Khaled. You don't see or hear him do anything. He's not doing enough to be affording that house. That's what I say, man. It's all smoke and mirrors. As long as they're sacrificing, is either giving up their children, giving up other artists to be in these debt slave deals, or giving up their booty hole to you know who. That's the only way they're making money to stay in those houses. And it works like that with police brutality victims, which is why you never see them go after real justice. They go after them in the civil court, where money is going to be handed out. That's why they do it. A wrongful death suit, a civil suit, you're getting millions. And this is why they go to Freemasons who have children or descendants of Freemasons. Hey, we want to use your child or use your relative for a race war. Okay, you sacrifice them, and then you go, oh, okay, let me file the wrongful death civil suit, and then you get paid that way. So the same thing with the Canaanites did in ancient days, where they gave their children to Moloch. Because obviously they were getting something in return if they're giving their children to Moloch. They're getting status, they're getting money, and whoever's running Moloch was the ones that was like, okay, they're giving us their children. Make sure they are getting extra land, extra gold, extra resources because they're doing this. They're allowing us to stay in place with wealth. They're allowing us to give us taxes or tribute from them. So we have to give them a little something. for offering up their blood. And that's all they've done. They perfected it now. So now they do it in reverse. Instead of waiting to sacrifice later, they already come to him and say, hey, we're going to get you this amount of money. Sacrifice them and you'll get it. So what you're seeing right now, that the modern day Moloch, you're seeing it in these police brutality victims, these stabbing victims, these race wars that, you know, that they bring up. Anyway, that wasn't the meat of the show. I want to get into the purpose of the show was vowing. Has anyone ever said a vow or gave a vow to the Most High Yahuwah? Or maybe you don't know the rules of a vow. Because it could be dangerous if you didn't know how to watch your mouth. If you didn't know how to filter the words that come out of your mouth, and when you ask for the Most High for things, or you say you want to do something for the Most High, it could either make or break you by what you say when you say anything really to the Most High Yahuwah. In Deuteronomy 23:21-23, it says, when you shall vow a vow unto Yahuwah Elohaka, you shall not slack to pay it, for Yahuwah Elohaka will surely require it of you, and it would be a sin in you. So it's on you. When you shall vow a vow unto Yahuwah Elohaka, you shall not slack to pay it. But if you shall forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in you. So vowing is truly for people who are really entrenched in this walk. Truly. Because if you vow anything to the Most High Yahuwah and you do not pay it, or you do not bring it to completion of this vow, it is destruction unto you. That which is gone out of your lips, you shall guard and perform, even a freewill offering according as you have vowed unto Yahuwah Elohaka, which you have promised with your mouth. Life and death is in the power of the tongue. So if you are not fully entrenched in this walk, I will not advise you to say a vow. You do not want to stumble or become a snare unto yourself by promising to do something for the Most High and don't do it. Some examples of vowing is Genesis 28:20-22. And Yaakov vowed a vow, saying, if Yahuwah will be with me and will guard me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall Yahuwah be my Yahuwah, be my Elohim. And this stone, which I have set for a pillar, shall be Yahuwah's house. And of all that you shall give me, I will surely give the tenth unto you. This is where we get the tenth in churches. We don't even know what made us give a tenth. We didn't even know as children what a tenth was. We never had a tenth of anything. But we know that our parents gave us a dollar. And that's supposedly been, I don't know how that's a tenth of absolutely nothing, because we didn't make money. I know some of you have or were given allowances, and you had money. But for some of us who never had an allowance, our parents just gave us a quarter or gave us a dollar and told us to put it in a collection plate for the building fund and for other stuff that we don't even know where that money even went to. But that's where the tenth went to. I don't even think my parents at the time they were going to church, I don't even think they were given a tenth of anything. It was just something to say. And now they try to sow a seed. You're sowing seed, which is more than a tenth. Now they're asking for $1,000 seed, $10,000 seed, $5,000 seed, locking the doors of the church so somebody can give them a seed. They're not even about a tenth no more. That should already tell you to come out of these churches. But for Yaakov, he said, he put the test to Yahuwah. He said, if he will guard me in this way, give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come into my father's house in peace, then Yahuwah will be my God. So he put Yahuwah to the test in this vow. And from there, he was given Yahuwah a tenth from what he got from Levon, his uncle. That's just one way you could do a vow. Oh, if the Most High can bring me up out of this trouble, he can bring me out of being stiff-necked, if he can bring me out of this snare, this pit, this stumbling block, I will turn my heart to Yahuwah the best of my ability, and I will perform all of his works. That's a safe vow. But don't get into trying to vow above your means or above your ruach. Oh, if the Most High gives me this, I will never do this again. I will never be here. I will never be over there. Do not even put yourself in that situation if you are truly not entrenched with the Most High's ruach. And don't be silly with vows either and saying something that you have no control over and get tested and you find out the price is more than you could bear, especially in the vow of Yiftach, which I talked about in Judges 11:30-39. It says, "And Yiftach vowed a vow unto Yahuwah and said, if you shall without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that whatsoever comes forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall surely be Yahuwah's, and I will offer it up for an ascending smoke offering." So already, why? Why would he need to say this? It was a silly vow to me. Because one, the Most High was going to give our enemies into our hands anyway, because that's what he told us to do. He told us, you better destroy these nations that are around about you, because they will be a snare and a stumbling block to you, because they will cause you to follow after their false gods. Just off the strength of him telling us, you better start removing these nations around about you, I would need to make no vow to him. And then you bring the vow to your household, especially you don't know who could show up. And you not to think if any relative or somebody you really loved ever being at the doors of your household, did you not think before that came out of your mouth? But yet it came out of his mouth. So Yiftach passed over unto the children of Ammon to fight against them, and Yahuwah delivered them into his hands. And he smote them from Aroer, even till you come to Minnith, even 20 cities, and unto Avel Karim with a great slaughter. Thus the children of Ammon were subdued before the children of Yasharel. And it came to pass when he saw her, when he came upon the house after this war, after the Most High gave the children of Ammon into his hands, he went home. And what did he see? And when he came to pass, when he saw her, that he rent his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you are one of them that trouble me. For I have opened my mouth unto El Yahuwah, and I cannot go back." How is this his daughter's fault? This is his fault. How is this his daughter's fault? Did he not tell this vow to Yahuwah himself privately? I guarantee you he didn't tell this in front of his daughter, because she, even if she didn't have the power to say anything, I'm pretty sure she would have looked at him weird. So why would he say this? "You have brought me very low." No, your mouth has brought you very low. You made this vow. And she said unto him, "My father, if you have opened your mouth unto El Yahuwah, do to me according to that which has proceeded out of your mouth. For as much as Yahuwah has taken vengeance for you of your enemies, even of the children of Ammon," and she said unto her father, "Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months, that I may go up and down upon the mountains and bewail my virginity, I and my fellows." And he said, "Go." And he sent her away for 2 months, and she went with her companions and bewailed her virginity upon the mountains. And it came to pass at the end of 2 months that she returned unto her father, who did with her according to his vow, which he had vowed, and she knew no man. And it was a custom in Yasharel, a custom for the women to go upon the mountains 4 days out of the year, four times, to bewail their virginity as an honor to this daughter. So he made her an ascending smoke offering, and he made her as a lamb without blemish, because she was a virgin. So that's two sides of this offering. One, she wasn't blemished. She was holy. She was righteous. She was upright. Just like the Most High calls us to offer fruit or meat or livestock, he tells us to offer it without blemish, without spot, righteous, holy, pure, upright. And his mouth got him in trouble. His vow got him in trouble. So don't say anything silly that brings judgment to your household. If even if you don't fulfill the vow, don't let it be something that has something to do with your household. And if you fulfill a vow, don't let it be something that could damage your household either. Now, between man and woman, the vow is talked about in Numbers 30, verses 2 through 12. If a man vows a vow unto Yahuwah or swears seven oaths to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. This is why, over time, I started talking less and less, because I do not want my words to come back and bite me in the butt. This is why Yahusha never spoke so much. He made his words few, clear, enough for even the parables, enough to either understand them or truly don't get it. And obviously, he didn't care if you didn't get it. He only cared that the disciples got it. So in order to understand the parables, you needed to be a disciple. In order to understand the parable, you needed to follow the law, says commandments, which is what the disciples followed. If they're walking with Yahusha himself, that's exactly what they would have to do to understand the parables. And even then at the time, they didn't understand it because they weren't given the Ruach HaKodesh to understand it. He had to tell them. So it's the same way. When he's gone, he gave us the Ruach HaKodesh for us to understand the parables now. But he said to them, it wasn't given the kingdom of heaven for them to know. Mind you, he's talking to a multitude of people. And then he's talking about a very few that he wanted to understand this. So he knew that the multitude weren't going to be true disciples. They were curious about what he was saying. They were curious about the way, but they weren't really ready to be true disciples, which is why he said that. So this is me learning from him, is why would I need to over-talk? Why would I need to over-explain? I rely on the Ruach HaKodesh to make all things or manifest all things to me, so I don't have to over-explain myself. Oh, where am I? If a woman also vows a vow unto Yahuwah and binds herself by a bond, being in her father's house in her youth, and her father hears her vow and her bond wherewith she has bond her soul, and her father shall hold his peace at her, then all her vows shall stand, every vow and every bond wherewith she has bound her soul shall stand. So this is for fathers and daughters. If your daughter makes a vow and you hear it and you think it's an acceptable vow for her to speak, then you let it go on. But if you don't agree with this vow, you can shut it down in order to save her soul. I think that's very important. It starts with the man understanding what his role is in the household and what he understands a real vow is supposed to be. He decides if it's damaging or it's going to bring forth fruit. So truly, you men, you are the last line of defense when anything is said amongst your household before it reaches Yahuwah in concerning a vow. But if her father disallows her in the day that he hears, not any of her vows or of her bonds, wherewith she has bond her soul shall stand, and Yahuwah shall forgive her because her father disallowed her. So if it's something like, oh, Yahuwah, if I do this, I promise I'll never do this again. And if your father knows you and knows his daughter, and be like, no, I know she's not going to be able to accomplish this, he's going to step in and say, no, I don't want you to do this vow, saving her. So the Most High Yahuwah can forgive her before she causes destruction upon her own soul. And if she had at all a man when she vowed or uttered out of her lips wherewith she bound her soul, and her man heard it and held his peace at her, and the day that he heard it, Then her vows shall stand, and her bonds wherewith she bound her soul shall stand. Again, that goes from the father to the man, to the husband. But if her man disallowed her on the day that he heard it, then he shall make her vow which she vowed, and that which she uttered with her lips, wherewith she bound her soul, of no effect, and Yahuwah shall forgive her. But every vow of a widow and of her that is divorced, wherewith they have bound their souls, shall stand against her, because she has no covering. And if she vowed in her man's house or bound her soul by a bond with an oath, and her man heard it and held his peace at her and disallowed her not, then all her vows shall stand, and every bond wherewith she bound her soul shall stand. But if her man has utterly made them void on the day he heard them, then whatsoever proceeded out of her lips concerning her vows or concerning the bond of her soul shall not stand. Her man has made them void, and Yahuwah shall forgive her. Again, this is the Most High completing the work in Genesis when he said to the woman that your man will rule over you. That means rule over your tongue and making sure you don't say anything that's going to destroy the marriage, destroy the household, or destroy the relationship between you and the Most High Yahuwah. Truly is a responsibility all on the man, because he has to know you inside and out. He has to know what he's working with. He has to know what he married. He has to know what he brought into this world and what he shares blood with. He has to know before anything is uttered out of your mouth to the Most High Yahuwah in a vow. And he has to know if you are able to accomplish it or not. So this is why I say a couple of episodes later, from when I talked about the comment that I got an email about how to deal with a partner who is not in the truth, but you are. And I say this as for a man, if you are a man in the truth and your woman is not in the truth, show grace, show patience, but also know how to rule and know how to project strength when it comes to the words of a woman. You do not want your house upended because of words and words that are out of order, especially when you are in charge or in this walk as a servant of Yahuwah. Now, if you are a woman in this walk and your man is not, then it is your job to still be under this covering, that you need to show respect. You also need to give patience and grace. But you also watch what you say out of your mouth, because just because you know and he don't know does not mean you usurp authority. You go to the Heavenly Father. But you be practical. If you're going to give a vow to the Most High Yahuwah concerning your husband, it better be in front of him. You better bring this conversation to him first so he can understand that he has the power to allow or disallow the vow, even if he's not in the truth. So open communication is best. Do not go into the dark or go into the closet and say, oh, I vow that if you do this to my husband, da, da, da. I mean, why? Because now the Most High Yahuwah is going to look on your actions. And if your actions aren't upright and pure because you know the truth, you do not want him to upend the entire household. Now, the Most High is merciful and long-suffering, but I'm just saying, it becomes a pattern with us when we think that this is the way or this is the truth in the path that we follow with our own understanding. And we continue to do it until we get stung or reprimanded. I'm saying that do not put yourself in a situation. Do not be a hindrance. I think is the bottom line of this. Do not be a hindrance because you know and they don't know. Don't become a stumbling block to them because you know and they don't. Bring them in to the conversation and show them that they have power. And maybe they'll turn to the walk and understand that they have this power now, that they have the ability to vow. If a man allow and disallow, as a woman, giving respect unto your covering. Maybe that'll call a man that is not in this walk into the walk. Because you don't know what preconceived notions that people have about the Most High God and thinking that it's about destroying families, destroying children, destroying nations, and not really know the reason why he did this. That he's so righteous and so pure that he'll call you out on your words if they're talked without a filter. It'll bring you into submission. But it'd be loving kindly. He will show loving kindness in trying to understand that you need to watch what you say. And so many people have been in this world for so long, they never watch what they say. They've never been tested on their words. Never. Never. So that's when so many people just talk and lie out of their mouth because they've never really felt the discipline that comes from it. Or some people talk so much, they don't even know what they say out their mouth. And they forget what they say. But in Enoch, it says that everything we say out of our mouths is being recorded. So you get to judgment. You get sit in that judgment seat and you say, oh, I don't know. And the Most High bring up, say, the Most High got the ultimate screenshots. He'll tell you exactly what you said, whatever you didn't think you said it, or whatever time you think you didn't say it, he'll bring it up in front of your face on the day of judgment. So you can act like, oh, I forgot. It don't matter no more because it was so many years ago. It's being recorded. The angels are recording it. Just like there is an angel of the presence that recorded all of the history of the children of Yasharel and told it to Moses or Moshe on Mount Sinai, I guarantee you, when it comes to our souls, it's being written down as we speak. So just because you don't remember, it don't mean nothing because the Most High remembers. So learning how to control your words, learning what you say, could benefit you in the long run, especially when you're making vows. Because if you're making vows around somebody who knows you and they know you're not going to complete them, you're just going to be upset at yourself because you're like, well, why he won't let my vows stand? Because you don't stand when it comes to the truth, or you can't stand when it comes to the things you say out of your mouth. Finish it off 14 through 16 in Numbers 30. But if a man altogether holds his peace at her from day to day, and he establishes all her vows or all her bonds, which are upon her, he confirms them because he held his peace at her in the day that he heard them. But he shall anyways make them void after that he has heard them. Then he shall bear her iniquity. So again, it's the responsibility of the men. These are the statutes which Yahuwah commanded Moshe between a man and his woman, between the father and his daughter. Bring ye yet in her youth, in her father's house. But if, like, I'm going to go back to 15. But if he shall any ways make them void after that he has heard them, then he shall bear her iniquity. So basically, if what she says is allowed and she fail, you bearing that iniquity because you sat there and listened to her knowing that she's not going to be able to complete these vows and you let it ride. So then you bear that iniquity. So it's a responsibility for us as men to know what you're dealing with, to understand and listen fully to what is being said out of your daughter's mouth and out of your wife's mouth. I'll end it with Kana, her vow in 1 Samuel chapter 1. Now, there was a certain man of Ramathaim, Sophim of Mount Ephraim, and his wife named Elkanah, and the son of Jerocham, the son of Eliu, the son of Toshu, the son of Suf, and Ephraimite. And he had two women. The name of one was Kana, and the name of the other was Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Kana had no children. So this is a brother with two wives. And this man went up out of the city yearly to worship and sacrifice to Yahuwah Sabaoth in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli and Chophani and Phinehas, the priest of Yahuwah, were there. And when the time was that Elkanah offered, and he gave to Peninnah his woman and to all her sons and her daughters portions, but unto Kana He gave a worthy portion, for he loved Kana, but Yahuwah had shut up her womb. And her adversary also provoked her sore, for to make her fret because Yahuwah had shut up her womb. So now she getting mocked. She getting mocked because she couldn't bring forth children. What a time to be alive at that moment. That the biggest thing that women held over each other's heads was their ability to bring forth children. Now, the children of Yasharel are talking about F them kids. Now they're bragging about, truly bragging about, not having kids in their 30s, their 40s, and their 50s, not having a man. They're bragging about this, like this is something to look forward to. They're bragging that they're able to travel and have fun. You could do that with kids and a marriage. Even more so because you don't share all of the financial responsibilities when your man takes you on a vacation. But women bragging about spending their own money on vacations and being able to travel and not having kids. Now that's something they're trying to hold over other women's heads. That, ha, 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 I don't have a man. I'm not getting cheated on. Ha, 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 I don't have multiple children that are uncooperative and I get to have my freedom and my life. Which is what they wanted, what this system wanted you to do. This system wants you to be single forever because you're easily moved into a 15-minute smart city. You're easily moved into a building or a complex that they can control. And they can control this complex based on whatever doctrines that they want to enforce upon a building. Like, so say if the New World Order comes in and they want everybody to have the digital mark on their head and or on their wrist or in their hand, and they tell you, you can't go and live in this facility or this complex or even your apartment, you can't live here anymore if you do not have this mark. Mind you, Satan can cause you, but are you going to uproot yourself, your job, and look for something else because you now can't afford, not even financially, you can't afford spiritually to be in this apartment complex. You don't want to taint your blood. So what are you going to do? You're going to jump to another apartment. That's why they don't want you in houses anymore. Because obviously you can't do this in residential areas. It's going to take longer. I mean, those HOAs that they have, I mean, they're getting so out of control. I could see that being an issue. Like, oh, you can't live in this system. You can't live in this neighborhood unless you have the mark. This is a statute and an ordinance that our HOA has put in here. You can't live here if you don't have the mark. I could see them doing that, but I'm telling you, they don't have that much time to go through with it. And that's probably what the Most High saw. He saw that was going to be the standard wherever we go. Not just buying and selling, but obviously knowing where we live at. That it could impose this mark. So what are these women going to do when they continue to raise rent and price you out and you're not able to afford even renting a house? So you have to go into the city. That's what they're doing, funneling you into the city while all these BlackRock and Vanguard real estate companies buy up neighborhoods and then pricing them so high. So now you have no choice but to go into an apartment complex. An apartment complex that it could change the status and statutes and ordinances so that you can get the mark. What are you going to be bragging about and boasting about then? You're going to be wishing a man has taken care of these things so you can stay in the house and away from this system. But you won't. You become collateral damage to it. And her adversary provoked her sore for to make her fret because Yahuwah has shut up her womb. And as he did so year by year, and when she went up to the house of Yahuwah, so she provoked her. Therefore, she wept and did not eat. So, damn, this woman, from the time she woke up to the time she went to the temple to pray, to seek Yahuwah, this woman, probably the other wife, running behind her, like, ah, ha, ha, you're not getting pregnant. Ah, ha, ha, he shut up your womb. Ha, ha, ha. Wouldn't that cause you to drink? Wouldn't that cause you to feel sorrowful that you couldn't bear children, which is your main purpose on this earth? Sorry if there's any feminists listening to me, but that at the time, that was their purpose. Then said Elkanah, her man, to Hannah, why do you weep? And why you eat not? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh, and after they had drunk. Now Eli, the priest, sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of Yahuwah, and she was in bitterness of her soul. and prayed unto Yahuwah and wept sore. And she vowed a vow and said, O Yahuwah Sabaoth, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your handmaid and remember me, and not forget your handmaid, but will give unto your handmaid a male child, then I will give him unto Yahuwah all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. That's her vow. Give me a son. Give me a son, and I will give him to you. I will bring forth a male child. In all the days of his life, there shall no razor come upon his head. Not cutting his hair. I think that's a decent vow. Very decent. It's the same vow of the Nazarene that could be found, we know him as Samson. That could be found in Judges 13. And the children of Yisrael did evil again in the sight of Yahuwah, and Yahuwah delivered them into the hand of the Philistines 40 years. And there was a certain man of Soorah, of the family of Dan, whose name was Manoach, and his woman was barren and bore not. Seems like she got the same problem with Cana. And the angel of Yahuwah appeared unto the woman and said unto her, Behold now, you are barren and bear not, but you shall conceive and bear a son. And they said, For lo, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come on his head. For the child shall be a Nazarene unto Yahuwah. From the womb he shall begin to deliver Yisrael out of the hand of the Philistines. So going back, it's 1 Samuel chapter 1, 13 through 19. Now Cana, she spoke in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she had been drunken. And Eli said unto her, How long will you be drunken? Put away your wine from you. And Cana said, No, my Adonai, I am a woman of sorrowful ruach. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I poured out my soul before Yahuwah. Could not count not your handmaid for a daughter of Belial, which is a worthless daughter. For out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. So, if you go back again to Judges 13, verses 4. Now therefore, beware, I pray you, and drink not wine or strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing. That was the rule. So going back to Cana, now I'm just speculating. Was the reason why she was barren is because she started to drink because the other wife started provoking her? So how would Eli, her man, know that she was drunk if she was a drinker, if she wasn't a drinker, if she showed signs of this is how she acted when she was drunk? Was she a talker when she drunk? I mean, most people become talkers when they're drunk. Because obviously he's seen her drink and seen her be talkative when she drinks. For him to accuse her and say, how long were you going to be drunk? Put the wine away from you because you're starting to do this thing where you're mumbling or you're talking under your breath. That may be something that she did when she was drinking. And why was she drinking? Possibly because she was being provoked. So the Most High wasn't going to allow her to bring forth any fruit that was meant for him based on the dietary items before she even became pregnant. It's the same thing the Most High told his angel to tell the mother of Samson. Don't eat any unclean thing. Don't drink wine or any strong drink. But he's going to belong to me as a Nazarene. So she vowed a vow, saying that she wanted a male child. But before she could want a male child, she had to get her dietary needs or restrictions in place. So I'm only observing that she could possibly have been a drinker, and it was the reason why her womb had to be shut up. Obviously, Samson's mother was drinking wine and having strong drink for her to be told that she could never drink it. Now, if she came into this world and was never a drinker of wine or strong drink, the angel would never told her hey, you can't drink wine anymore. You can't drink strong drink. Obviously, that's exactly what she was doing. So for Kana, if she was looked at as somebody who was mumbling or talking drunk, then obviously her mom is like noticing that she's demonstrating the same behaviors being drunk, is what I'm saying. So he's telling her, put the wine away from you. So I guarantee you, after she had made this vow, she may have not ever touched wine or strong drink again because she was blessed with a son. Then Eli answered and said, go in peace, and the Elohim of Yasharel grant you your petition that you have asked of him. And she said, let your handmaid find grace in your sight. So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no longer sad. Now, it didn't say she ate and drank. It said she just ate. And they rose up in the morning early and worshiped before Yahuwah and returned and came to their house to Ramah. And Elkanah knew Kana, his woman, and Yahuwah remembered her. So the vow is powerful, but also you have to put yourself in place of this vow. You have to be upright, you have to be pure, and you have to know what you're offering. And know that these vows come with conditions, and maybe unspoken conditions, but they're vows nonetheless. So if I vow a vow to the Most High Yahuwah, I need to bring it into completion. But before I do, I need to be right in Ruach. I need to be entrenched with all of what the Most High is talking about. Even though I may stumble, I may fall and become a snare unto myself, either through folly or not understanding the scriptures, I still stay on the path. And I test the Most High Yahuwah through my vow. And he has tested me through the vow or the words out of my mouth. I think that is important before you get any vow ready to leave your lips. You don't bring destruction to your household, and you don't vow something that is far above your ruach at the time. So I thought that was just an amazing coincidence that Kana wanted to bear a male child, and the vow was to never let a razor come upon his head. And then Samson's mother almost having the same exact story, or being told that you can never have strong drink or wine when you conceive this child, that you should never put a razor upon his head. And if Kana was a drinker only because she was being provoked into drinking and not being able to bear a son, that it came an unspoken condition with her, that she just didn't drink any wine or strong drink, as she probably has before, that she chose to give that up in order to vow a vow to Yahuwah to set herself right, upright and pure, to conceive a child. And she also said that she would never let a razor come upon his head. And then he became the prophet Samuel, a Levite, in the days of David. So he was very, 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 very profitable as a priest. So this is one of these stories that you can seek understanding in, especially when it comes to vows and the things we say out our mouth, and making sure we repay the Most High everything that we say we're going to do for him, and for him to do something for us. Very important. So again, I'm repeating myself. Please get prayer. Please get a shout out. Love in your hearts for Brother McFadden, who is going through this tough time of trying to get back on the path that the Most High Yahuwah has laid out for us, so us to be righteous and perfect and upright, and for us to truly understand the calling that he has called this assembly to understand and to walk in the path of righteousness.